Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your get a fun pass of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. An anti-hero, what's the opposite of the opposite of the opposite of a hero? That's Taylor, not singing about Ticketmaster necessarily, but there have been a number of issues in the ticketing world recently, and it is starting, I think, maybe to force artists to think a little bit harder about the choices that they are making in regards to ticketing and ticket prices and accommodating fans at a price point that is not bank breaking. Now, this has happened time and again. This feels very cyclical in that marketplace, but there does seem to be a sort of critical mass of negative energy directed at the Ticketmaster Live Nation ecosystem right now. If something is going wrong in a venue, you know Ben Cesario is documenting it and paying attention to it. Ben, what's up, man? Welcome.
Thank you.
Ben is our music business reporter, as you know. And this week, I wanted to get under the hood to the best degree possible of everything that has been going on with ticketing lately, and also put this in a little bit of historical context, because as I mentioned, this is not by no means the first time that this has happened. This is a Pearl Jam thing. This is a Springsteen thing. It comes up over and over again. But Ben, it does seem like the last, let's say, 3-4 months, the action around Ticketmaster and ticketing and people complaining openly about it seems to be vibrating at a pretty high frequency. You have the Taylor tour issues with the rollout for the stadium tour coming up this year. You have the Bad Bunny Mexico City debacle. You've got Zach Bryan, the rising country adjacent star, making whooping on Ticketmaster's heads like part of his own marketing campaign. I guess the first question is a simple one, which is anything actually different now, or are people just tuned in right now?
I don't think anything is all that different in terms of what Ticketmaster does and what has happened. I do think that the Taylor debacle is what is different. Like, the difference is Taylor, because she's so big, she's so prominent, she has so many fans, and her tour is like such a gigantic moment in pop culture that I think it is kind of the thing that, like, every person, every young person in the country, every parent of a young person, anybody who's paying the smallest amount of attention to popular culture is very aware of this. And that means that Washington is very aware of it. So the heat is definitely on. But as you said, it's happened before. So I don't think that anything is all that fundamentally different.
The Taylor Stadium tour starting in a couple of months. Can you talk us through exactly what went wrong with the on sales? Because it seemed like it was a cascade of problems when the on sales happened. And even maybe for some folks who do not pay attention or buy tickets in the on sale period, maybe even talk about how there are different on sales for different types of customers, fan organizations, credit card holders, et cetera, et cetera.
I think 51 stadiums for 51 stadium shows that she was putting on sale essentially at the same time. And that's a few million tickets. That's a very big on sale. And it's Taylor's first tour in, what is it, about 5 years?
Yeah, since before COVID. Yeah.
And she's put out all this music. And I think her angle of the Eras tour is like a brilliant marketing move that I think really stirred up the fan base. And so people may not realize this is a like Beatlemania type moment of fans wanting tickets. So the question is, what went wrong? I mean, on the most basic level, there's an extreme imbalance of supply and demand. That is something that is not unique to Taylor's on sale. We've seen it again and again and again with big stars going on tour. It's happened with Adele. It's happened with Beyonce. It's happened with Springsteen. And that's the way it has to be. There has to be more people trying to get into the big show than there are seats in the room.
Can you just explain that a little bit? Like, I understand that as like an economic concept, but can you explain how that actually functions? why can't it be a perfect system, a perfect marketplace where there are 10,000 seats and 10,000 people who want the seats? Why does it have to be 15,000 people who want the seats for 10,000 seats?
Well, I think if there were a perfect market, then there would be like a venue with just enough seats for all of the an artist's fans in a particular area. But of course, that's not the case. And there's venues of different sizes, and it's going to depend on a lot of things about like how good the artist's music is and how fans are into it. I think if you imagine like a pre-internet era of people lining up outside a box office to get a ticket, that's a good image to keep in mind of just like there are seats in the house. There are people out there trying to get in. And, you know, for an artist, it's always a good thing to leave people wanting more and to have a line out the door showing that there's more people trying to get in. Artists would rather there be people who can't get in than have extra seats unsold.
This is also like a club keeping you outside and saying we're at capacity. And that lets you know that the club is hot.
Now, if you add the internet to that equation, and it's not just the number of people who are available in their town on a Saturday morning at 10 a.m. to line up outside, it's every single person at a computer. And then all the people who have bot programs running on their like scalping trading desks, the amount of traffic for that kind of a thing is just mind-boggling. And it was mind-boggling a decade ago. I'm not even sure what the state of the art is now, but this is a problem that is not just a Ticketmaster problem. Like, this is an internet problem. This is a Twitter problem, a politics problem of just like the pollution on the internet of bots and bad actors. And so there's every fan trying to get the ticket. And then there's the people trying to get the ticket to scalp it to the fan. And that's a very big factor to include in all of this.
Now, here's the thing with scalpers, right? Like, scalpers are motivated purely by the marketplace. They perceive a gap between supply and demand. They think that they can profit off of it. They are aware of the thing that Ticketmaster is aware of, Taylor Swift is aware of, but many fans maybe are not totally aware of, which is that the actual value, quote unquote, of a ticket is likely higher than its face value that it's sold at. That's an inefficiency in the marketplace that scalpers swoop in to take advantage of, not to get all ecten about it. But this has always been the case. There's always been scalping. There's always been a secondary marketplace, formal or informal. The internet has formalized it and smoothed it out, but that's always the case. The shock that people tend to express about it sometimes to me feels a little disingenuous, but I do think that I think the first time that you encounter it, especially as a young fan, especially as a passionate fan who really wants access to a tour and is having trouble getting access to a tour, that passion running up against the cold reality of how supply and demand works can be pretty jarring. And that's what you see happening with all the kind of technical issues with the Taylor rollout, but also the kind of the immediate bumping up of the prices of the tickets.
One factor is just the supply and demand and the participation of scalpers getting in there. But then there's Ticketmaster and how it operated and how it ran the on sale. And like the basic explanation is that they fumbled the ball about just handling all that incoming demand. They have this system called Verified Fan, which is intended to minimize some of that chaos, which is that you have to register in advance. You say you're interested for, you know, a show at this particular venue, and they kind of scan you and try to figure out if you're a real person or a scalper. And they have access to like what other concert tickets have you bought and so forth. And if you pass the, you know, retinal scan, they give you a code that you can use to buy the ticket. They messed this up. One person in the sort of live industry that I happened to talk to about this was just very surprised, because this Verified Fan thing is essentially a way to test the water in advance. It's a way for Ticketmaster to know how many people are interested. And they got a huge amount of interest. They got a gigantic amount of interest from fans, and that should have told them something. They kind of have a formula they use to say, well, if we get this many, you know, registrations, let's increase it by that much, and that's about how many tickets we're going to sell. They were way, 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 way off. From what I understand, because I wasn't trying to buy a ticket the first day. I tried the second day, and I think I had the same experience. But what happened is you would log into Ticketmaster, you would make sure your credit card's up to date and all that stuff, and then you sit there and wait. And if you were given the thumbs up by this verified fan thing, they gave you a code the night before. They give you some little alphanumeric password to use. And so you're supposed to be able to use this to get your ticket. The first problem is they could have weeded out a lot of the traffic by asking for that code first. Instead, there are millions and millions of people in the queue waiting to get to the point where they enter in their code.
All those people did not have codes.
Not all of them, certainly. Ticketmaster has said, and very credibly, they were just like bombarded by millions of hits and presumably many bots. And also probably people like me who were like, nah, I didn't bother. I'm just going to see if I can get tickets. Why not?
You are not a verified fan, Ben?
I've used it. I've used it in the past and like it's worked for me on different things, but I just didn't go through the rigmarole of doing it this time. But I did test it myself just as a Joe Schmo to like see like what happens.
I don't mean this in the big picture way, but like in a small and narrow way as I can ask this question. Did Ticketmaster, did they do nothing wrong? Because there was always going to be an improbable amount of demand. There was always going to be bots coming for these tickets. There was always going to be more people attempting to access the product than people who had earned or a legitimate right to access the product. Is there no way that they could have handled this better?
I think there's a lot of ways they could have handled it better. One is that they could have anticipated that demand better. They had a strong indication that it was going to be stronger than they had thought. Then there's some of the design of the system, like I mentioned, where they could have kicked people out of the queue. There's a lot of anecdotal stories that have popped up on social media and have been reported around about people who got in, clicked the ticket, and it went into their shopping cart, and then they went to pay for it, and it disappeared. So there were all of these system failures. There was also an interesting piece, I think, on Slate about the verified fan system. And the way they were pitching it to fans was basically like, hey, if you've bought a bunch of Taylor merch, you've got a better shot than somebody else. The more money you spent on Taylor, the more you've proved yourself as a fan, and therefore the better your chances of being given the thumbs up by the robot system here. And you're going to get it. And the indications were that that just simply failed, that like people who bought a bunch of Taylor t-shirts and stuff thinking that it would help them didn't get it. And other people who did nothing did get it. So on the first day of this on sale, and as you mentioned, there's like a staggered process where they opened it up for this verified fan. And usually what happens is they kind of like divide the house into chunks and say, we're going to sell 20% of the tickets on this day. And then the next day, there's like a credit card sponsorship pre-sale. And then maybe the next day, there's some other fan club or something or other. And usually there's these tiers, depending on what kind of credit card you have. If you're a member of this club or that club, you have different chances to get the ticket. This time, they sold almost all of the tickets with the verified fan thing on the first day. That was quite eye-opening. And to me, that implied that they made some kind of decision along the way that like, hey, boss, there's just so many people buying tickets. Maybe we just need to sell everything in the house. We're going to turn away 10 times more people if we just hold it to 25%. I have no idea. I have no idea what Taylor's plan was, what Ticketmaster's plan was, but it was peculiar that they sold virtually everything in that first day.
Okay, can I ask a question? I feel like I'm fully devil's advocating here this entire episode so far, but am I just old to where I no longer the expectation that I might get a ticket at face value on the day the ticket comes out? I have zero expectation that will ever happen. Have I just lived too long to know that this is always going to be the case? And that's why I'm not shocked by it. Have I been supreme pilled, Nike sneakers app pilled, understanding that there will always be more demand than supply for a coveted product. And I am certainly in the last 10 years resigned to pay the resale price for items like that, just because I, Lord knows, I don't care enough to sit there and click on the day of release, at the minute of release. Am I just too far gone at this point? And everybody that is complaining is encountering this for the first time? Or is there something more sinister at play with this marketplace?
I think both can be true. I think that you and I were long in the tooth. And like, you know, I remember having this feeling about Radiohead tickets like 10 years ago or something, of just like, why even bother? But I do think that that's a relatively narrow slice of the overall marketplace. And when you think of the people who are going to be interested in the Taylor Swift tour, there's a lot of young people. There's a lot of parents of those young people. And remember, people haven't been going to shows for a couple of years. Maybe there are people who the last time Taylor toured were 13 and they didn't have any idea how it worked. Somebody bought the ticket for them, somebody's mom. I do think there was a lot of outrage from young fans who don't look like, or at least the I'm guessing from their social media posts, that they've done this 100 times before. But I also think that there's a fair point to make of just the marketplace should be fair, whether one is a 14-year-old or whether one is a 40-year-old and has learned the ins and outs of things like buying concert tickets on the internet. Like, the marketplace is supposed to be fair to all consumers.
Yes. I mean, there's one obvious solution to this, which is Taylor Swift herself handpicks who gets to sit in every seat and checks them in individually when they arrive at the stadium and hugs them and says, you, Ben, I know that you are sitting in section 112, row 4, seat B, and gives you an incredible hug and says, thank you for being here, and does that with every single person. Talk about verified fan. Now we're cooking, right?
Or we do like a Hunger Games competition where people have to, you know, debase themselves to prove their fandom.
I've been doing that for 25 years. For everybody who is not long in the tooth, this is like a big wake up to supply and demand, how these systems work. But what are the things on top of that, that Ticketmaster and Live Nation are doing that are making this process even worse? You mentioned some of the kind of like logistics of how the line was working. What else do we know about that system writ large?
So one of the reactions that came almost immediately to the whole Taylor Swift ticket on sale thing was political outrage. AOC tweeted about it. Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, who's in the Senate, along with some other senators, complained about it. A lot of these people have been doing this for years, raising objections at various times. Sometimes when there's like some incident with a concert, other times when there isn't. But the idea that, is this company a monopoly? Is the combination of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, which the two of them merged 13 years ago now, is that an anti-competitive combination that harms the marketplace in general, meaning like other companies that may want to compete with them? And does it harm the public? And the theory there is that the size of Ticketmaster, the way it holds on to its clients, which are the venues, and the sort of what goes on behind the scenes of the music industry about trying to make those deals and keep them, do they engage in, it would be called anti-competitive conduct, but the more just kind of general common sense is like, are they bullies?
Can you talk through that a tiny bit in terms of the bullying? What would that actually mean? And this came up a little bit in the story that you published the other day about the Barclays Center, the subtext of that story. What would it mean in real terms for the biggest concert promoter in the country to be formally connected to and have collusive business practices with the biggest ticket broker / seller in the country? What does that do in real terms to venues and to artists?
Well, let me say two of the most boring words in the English language and just get them out there and promise people it will be interesting. Just hang in there. consent decree.
Woo!
All right. I know people salivate when they hear that. It's like, it's a sexy idea. So when Ticketmaster and Live Nation merged, it went under review by the Justice Department. There were a lot of objections raised throughout the whole music business that this combination would be bad for a lot of reasons. And the biggest one was that they would just be so big, that they'd be so much bigger than anybody else. It would be hard for any competitor to deal with them. One thing about Ticketmaster, which has been around for decades now, is that it had always kind of been viewed as like a Switzerland. Like it was not really a participant in the who's bidding for what shows kind of side of things. And once it became part of Live Nation, it essentially was. So Live Nation's competitors didn't really like the fact that Ticketmaster had visibility into their business. Like if a show is not selling well on Ticketmaster, that's the kind of thing that maybe Live Nation wouldn't have known about it, but now that they're one entity, maybe they do know about it. The government put into place, in order to approve the deal, this consent decree, which is just an agreement that's overseen by a judge. And there's all kinds of rules in there about what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And the key thing that has come up again and again and again with Live Nation is that when Ticketmaster is out bidding on new business, when they go to whatever arena or theater that's looking to make a new deal for ticketing, like who's going to handle the ticketing at Madison Square Garden or whatever the place is, Live Nation is not allowed to threaten that venue to say, if you don't take Ticketmaster, you're not going to get any of our tours. And if they do switch to a different ticketing provider, they're not allowed to withhold those tours and to divert them elsewhere. But it's very murky. There's been a lot of criticism of the consent decree itself because Live Nation is also allowed to what they call bundle services and use its own sort of judgment about, like, when they're planning a tour, what makes the most financial sense for us. In other words, where do we make the most money? And obviously, you make the most money when you both have the tour and sell the ticket. So it's come up again and again over the years. And 5 years ago now, I'm amazed it's been this long, but Graham Boley and I did an investigation about exactly this thing. And we documented a number of instances where this had happened. Live Nation denied it quite strongly. But then about a year later, the Justice Department essentially charged them with the same thing and extended the decree.
Okay, so I want to talk about what happened with Barclays Center recently, because it does seem germane to everything we're talking about. Let's come back after a break. So we were talking about Zach Bryan earlier. Zach Bryan has been on a Twitter tear about Ticketmaster, and we'll get into that a little bit down the line. He put out a live record on Christmas, I think, right around there, called All My Homies Hate Ticketmaster, live from Red Rocks. So let's listen to something from it. This is the opening song. It is Country Roads, which is Zach with Charles Wedley Godwin, Jonathan Payton, Abigail Payton. Back in a minute.
I'm in West Virginia, mountain mama, oh, take me home. Come on!
I play Wordle and Spelling Bee every single day.
That's the first thing I do, play Wordle while making coffee.
I pour myself a cup and do the crossword, which is the jewel of my morning.
I started Wordle 194 days ago, and I haven't missed a day.
So what's our starting word today?
I think it should be ocean.
Storm is a good one.
B-R-I-S-K, because it's a brisk day outside.
At this point, I'm probably more consistent with doing the crossword than brushing my teeth.
I don't think there's a day that I've missed it.
I'm definitely a Monday or Tuesday player right now, but I aspire to do Friday and Saturday puzzles.
I have seen you do spelling bee during meetings when you're supposed to be paying attention.
That never happens.
When you win a puzzle, where you get that you're a genius, I always take a screenshot and send it to my wife.
The New York Times crossword. It really is a moment of zen that cleanses my brain.
I wish the days were shorter and that the wordles were longer.
Join us and play all New York Times games
at nytimes.com/games.
We're back with Ben Cesario talking Ticketmaster and Live Nation and cyberbullying? Question mark. Ben, what what happened at Barclays Center in the last like 2 to 3 years? This full circle thing that's been going on.
So when Barclays Center opened about 10 years ago, it was a Ticketmaster venue. And it stayed that way until the fall of 2021 when they dropped Ticketmaster and they did a new deal with a company called SeatGeek, which started off as a StubHub type.
A resale marketplace.
A resale, right. And it was known for a really good sort of mobile interface that was really easy. You know, it told you like, hey, this is the best price, you know, that's come up for this seat kind of thing. Then they started getting into what's called the primary ticket market, which is the official box office sales when something goes on sale, like the Taylor tour. They've had some success. They have the Dallas Cowboys Stadium, which is one of the Taylor venues that she's going to on tour. So they've kind of like odd bedfellows with Ticketmaster on that because Ticketmaster did the entire tour with Verified Fan, including these couple of stadiums that SeatGeek did. So anyway, SeatGeek is sort of an upstart and they've been challenging Ticketmaster for a while and they've had some successes. And then very recently, I believe it was in the last few weeks, a deal was made by Barclays Center to switch back to Ticketmaster. And the strangest thing about this story is that when these ticketing companies do a deal with a venue, they're usually a fairly long term, 5 years, sometimes even 10 years, where there's advance money paid, the paperwork is done, sometimes the technology has to change over, and the venue is making a deal with that ticketing service that's for, you know, a bunch of years.
This was a 7-year deal in your story. You said the SeatGeek deal.
The SeatGeek deal was 7 years and they were like 15 months into it. So that is highly unusual and very eyebrow raising. And I have to say that the parties were very tight-lipped about what went on here. And so it is not entirely clear, did SeatGeek fail in some way? Were they fired by the venue for screwing something up? That's one possible explanation. The other possible explanation is, was Live Nation so mad about losing their client? And this is obviously a very high profile client that they might have retaliated against the venue and done what we talked about a minute ago, which is, did they divert tours away from it and to other places?
And as you point out in the story, there are other options in the New York City area that are similar sized. There's more competition now with other arenas. So if hypothetically Live Nation did want to steer tours elsewhere, there are other places to steer tours that there were not 5 years ago.
The biggest competition is Madison Square Garden. There's always been a competition there for as long as Barclays is open. The Garden is the prestige venue. Any artist is going to want, you know, the feather in their cap of playing Madison Square Garden. So there's that. But Barclays, it's Brooklyn. It, you know, it had the Jay-Z association. Like, it was seen as more cool. And so I think, like, there was a good competition between those two venues. There's also in Newark, there's the Prudential Center, which is a little bit of a different market. And then about a year ago, they opened the new arena on Long Island, the UBS Arena. Harry Styles, I believe, was the opening there. And that's much closer competition for Barclays. And it's also the new kid in town. So it is a competitive environment. I did pull some data. There's basically publicly available data about all the shows that different venues get. It comes from a publication called Pollstar, which tracks all this stuff. And there are some interesting indications in it. The number of Live Nation shows that went to Barclays Center after SeatGeek took over went down a little bit. The number of Live Nation shows at Madison Square Garden went up a little bit. UBS got a bunch. Prudential got a bunch. They don't seem to have suffered at all. But SeatGeek did seem to suffer a little bit. But the most peculiar thing about this information is that it wasn't just Live Nation shows that Barclays lost. They get all kinds of events from independent promoters. And there's also things like wrestling and Disney on Ice and comedians. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that are not concerts. That side of things also went down.
And does that, in your mind, indicate that something was potentially happening on the SeatGeek side, since that is the common thread linking everything?
It raises the question. I didn't feel that I was able to get a definitive answer in reporting the news here. But I mean, I did go to Live Nation and I said, there's this data here. You lost this venue after almost a decade, really high profile. You know, your competitor comes in and then a year later, they're out. And so I asked them, anybody is going to look at this information and wonder, did Live Nation retaliate against a venue? And the president of the company said, absolutely not. You know, he stated it on the record very forcefully. And so he was really the only person of the parties here between SeatGeek, Barclays, and Ticketmaster that went on the record.
Can I ask a sidebar question? It's more of a journalism question. I saw that in the piece, and I was wondering, why do you think he gets on the phone with you? Why don't they just no comment you? Why don't they just statement you? Why does he get on the phone? Is it something about him or the company understanding the optics of him not getting on the phone? What do you think the logic there is? Besides, obviously, you being persistent and asking the right questions. But I saw that and I was like, huh, I'm actually surprised that they subjected him, or he subjected himself, to being asked the questions directly. Is it because he wants to be able to go to Congress and say, I talked to the New York Times, I said in the New York Times, and I'll say it here too?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, one thing to keep in mind there is something happened between Barclays and SeatGeek. And I'm sure there was a separation deal that was lawyered up the wazoo, because both SeatGeek and Barclays did make milquetoast canned statements. And so something happened there and they split up. And so Live Nation was not part of that divorce. So they have the freedom in a way to say, hey, you know, we're just coming in here. Looks like, you know, the other guy screwed up. I think that their position as the incoming, you know, returning victor gives them something to brag about, denying on the record that they did anything there that they're not supposed to do will be helpful to them in a PR sense when, you know, any day now, they're probably going to be hauled before the Senate.
Perhaps one way to guarantee that you absolutely will get a ticket to the Taylor Swift tour is to be a senator calling hearings about what happens with the Ticketmaster and Live Nation. Or alternate idea, if anyone in the Senate is listening, hold the hearings at the stadium where Taylor is playing. Kill two birds with one stone. Just free game, as always, on Popcast. To circle a little back to the fans, and maybe this is where you can touch on the Bad Bunny thing that happened. Look, I don't know if Ticketmaster is good or bad. Obviously, you and I, like, we're fortunate. We get tickets to concerts. I buy tickets to concerts sometimes, but obviously we get tickets to concerts. And when I purchase tickets to concerts through Ticketmaster or whatever all else, generally it's fine. It's annoying, but, like, it's fine. I don't have any problems with it. But this thing that happened with the Bad Bunny show in Mexico would seem to indicate that there's, like, some flaw above and beyond what we're describing as, like, marketplace problems with Taylor, et cetera. Can you talk through a little bit what happened with that and what might that reflect about the Ticketmaster as a service?
What I understand is he played a stadium in Mexico City and there was crazy scalping in a way that really shocked Mexico. And the president of Mexico complained about it and really condemned Ticketmaster for allowing that. But then the bigger problem about just them doing their job is that there was a problem at the venue where people who had legitimate tickets were being turned away because there was some kind of problem with the, like, scanning system. And I believe it was Ticketmaster's own technology, from what I understand there. And so maybe the venue itself has some problem. I don't know. But Ticketmaster apologized for the problem. There were images on social media of, like, a half empty stadium because they turned away thousands of people. There was a problem with fake tickets, but then even the people who had authentic tickets were being turned away. And, you know, whether that's the venue's fault or Ticketmaster's fault, I don't know, but that's about as big of a problem as you can have. These two problems between Taylor and Bad Bunny, that they happen just within a few weeks of each other is a terrible thing for Ticketmaster, that literally the two biggest artists in the world, that they failed to do their jobs in a satisfactory way, and that they failed the artists, they failed the fans. That's a big problem for them.
Okay, but again, devil's advocate, maybe it's not a big problem because who else is going to do it? Every time there's a smaller ticketing concern that starts up, they end up getting bought by Ticketmaster, it seems like, or one of the other big companies. No matter what kind of intervention there is, whether it's from Swifties or from the Senate, it doesn't actually seem like there's a viable alternative at the moment that can handle the scale. And this is, again, to go back to like the idea of the perfect marketplace, the demand is always going to exponentially outstrip the supply. And there will always be people who are upset. And there will always be people who are left out. And the system is designed that way. So this has happened again. It's probably worth talking about Springsteen and whether ticket prices are being artificially inflated by the scalping market. It's worth mentioning the Pearl Jam issues from 15 or so years ago. None of this is new. It's new to this generation, but none of this is new. But is it just such a fundamentally intractable issue that no one is really incentivized to solve? It's like, in order to be a company that says we're going to go and solve this, you're literally choosing to jump into a fire, it would seem. And that would disincentivize, I imagine, a lot of people, no matter how much profit. Well, I suppose if the profits are really high, that's one
thing. There's a lot of profit.
There's a lot of profit. But is the problem just so fundamentally intractable that these imperfect systems are just the systems that we are all collectively doomed to live with?
So the monopoly question is the key one to answer what you're asking, which is, does Ticketmaster occupy such a gigantic incumbent position? And do they use any unfair techniques to hold on to their position, to prevent any competitor to come in and outseat them? And is it basically impossible for somebody to compete against them? Years ago, there was some indication that Amazon was interested in getting into ticketing. In Europe, they advertised this, they hired people, there were sort of job postings in Amazon US. Amazon was planning some kind of like Amazon ticketing system, and it was never super clear what they were going to do, but it was very mysterious that it just vanished. There were some indications from reporting, but nobody really, I don't think, totally pinned it down. But the idea that Amazon might have looked at this and said, we don't want to do this, is very strange. And there, as you said, there's a long history here of competitors to Ticketmaster either getting bought up or flailing and dying. There was a company called Songkick that had a way to do what Verified Fan is, where the whole idea was, we're going to go to artists' fan clubs and we're going to try to make sure that the fan club fans get the tickets and we're going to weed out all the scalpers. And they claimed that they had extraordinary success doing that, and that they were able to get the tickets into the right hands and weed out all the bots and scumbags, right? But then they got into this antitrust battle with Ticketmaster. They sued Ticketmaster, and they said that Ticketmaster was doing all this outrageous stuff, like threatening their clients. It went on and on. The case settled. Live Nation paid over $100 million, but the consequence was that Songkick was basically ripped apart. The company doesn't exist anymore in anything like the shape it was. And also, a few years later, there was a criminal case where it was found that Live Nation executives had illegally gotten access into their computer systems, into Songkick computer system. It was like corporate espionage. So there was a lot of smoke there about the dirty dealings behind the scenes. So the question is always, if the competitive marketplace was fair, meaning if a challenger to Ticketmaster was able to compete in a fair arena, maybe they would have done a better job with Taylor Swift. Maybe there would have been also more pressure on Ticketmaster to improve.
Right. But also it's like, we've been having these exact conversations about Ticketmaster for years. And certainly when it comes to ticket pricing, you've written about how certain artists hold back certain tickets and then sell them at a premium because they know that the marketplace is going to do that anyway. So why should the scalpers eat all that profit when it could go to the artist, which to me seems fine, broadly speaking, but you know, I understand why it doesn't seem fine to others. Truly, nothing has changed. Like, we could have had almost the exact same conversation 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
I agree.
Ultimately, I think a lot of people who are listening are probably encountering this for the first time. Do we just say to them, suck it up, kids? That's sort of how I feel. Like, I feel it's a terrible thing to say, but I'm just kind of like, by the time you're in your mid-30s to late-30s, like, this is going to be pretty normalized. You will understand that capitalism wears you down. It takes your skin. It thrashes it off your body. It takes your veins and your arteries and shreds them. It leaves you nothing but brittle bone.
You mentioned Pearl Jam earlier, right? And so Pearl Jam sued Ticketmaster in the 90s. And at the time, you know, I was a college student. I didn't have that much experience vying for tickets and dealing with, you know, there wasn't really any like online ticket scalping world at that point. But Pearl Jam sued. They lost. They went to war with Ticketmaster. And it even went to the stage of they tried to do a tour not going to Ticketmaster venues. They tried to go around them. They tried their damnedest and it didn't really work. And so they essentially gave up, right? And now, like, they use Ticketmaster like every other band in the world.
Is that true? I didn't actually know because I don't buy Pearl Jam tickets. They just said, ah, the hell with it.
They abandoned the fight and they continued touring in Ticketmaster venues and have done, you know, business with them. And they have used Verified Fan and they have used some of the other tools that Ticketmaster has. They have a way for artists to prevent resale or at least not have the resale take place within the Ticketmaster system. I don't want to misspeak about it. Off the top of my head, I can't remember all the details. Pearl Jam has essentially endorsed a lot of this stuff and said, you know what? It works. We're using it. You were just saying, you know, to the 20-year-olds of today, we're buying the Taylor Swift ticket and saying like, what? How can this be this way? Well, that is essentially the way it seemed to me 30 years ago, and I've continued going to concerts, and I hate it when I have to overpay. But I do think that one lesson to be learned about this is that the world ain't fair.
I know.
As you said.
These conversations do bring out the cynic in me, I have to be honest.
I also feel I need to say one more thing, and I have been covering Live Nation and Ticketmaster for years, and I've written plenty of critical stories about them, but do always try to be as fair as I possibly can be. And one of the things to remember about Ticketmaster is that they're essentially set up to be the punching bag. Yes, they do sell you the ticket, and yes, there are fees on it, but they're not the only hand in the pie that is getting that fee. And when they do some of these ticketing plans, they're doing it at the behest of their clients, the venues, and the artists. Now, Taylor, in her statement, it's relatively rare to get an artist complaining about Ticketmaster. And Taylor, I think, is one of the few that would do it. And it was interesting to see how polite and muted it was as a complaint. But one thing that she said, if you remember, was like, essentially, they told us they could handle this, and they didn't. That was about as strong a condemnation as you ever really get about Ticketmaster, because look what happened to Pearl Jam. And if you bite that hand, you're going to have to deal with them again in the future. So I do think that Ticketmaster is the vendor, like they're the face that the fan deals with. And so they look like the villain, but they're also kind of just the front door for whatever happens behind the scenes in the music business. And there's a lot of people taking those fees and who are complicit in things like raising the prices higher and higher and higher and saying, well, hey, looks like somebody bought my ticket on the secondary market for $1,000. So maybe $900 is a perfectly fair price.
Let me ask this. When someone like Taylor does register that complaint publicly, or when the Pearl Jam thing was happening, look, you've been reporting on this for a long time, and people, I'm sure, have spoken to you on the record and also on background. Do you get the sense internally at Ticketmaster that those complaints are taken seriously, or are they perceived more as a cost of doing business?
I think they are taken seriously. Sure, there's a certain amount of noise that they always get. They're used to it. They're used to the press releases from members of Congress. John Oliver did a segment about a year ago that was really harsh on Ticketmaster, and that was one of those moments that, like, it really bounced around, and, you know, your friends who don't buy 16 concert tickets in a row, like, saw that, you know, like, everybody saw that, and they're used to that. But I think that when Taylor speaks, people listen, and I think that they knew that they messed up, and they knew that they had to make Taylor happy and had to make her fans happy somehow. I do think they certainly heard her, and I think it shook them a bit. But as you said, it's not the first time.
And the problem itself is intractable. More demand than supply. This is an intractable problem. No, here's a way to solve the problem. Taylor could do 300 stadium shows and soak up all that excess demand. I guess that could happen. It's not going to.
Yes, there's always going to be more fans to see a superstar artist, whether that's Taylor, Adele, Bruce Springsteen, whoever, right? There's always going to be more demand than supply for those seats. That will never change. But when it becomes a sort of like data traffic and authenticity scanning of customers, when it becomes that, I don't know if it's an intractable problem. I don't know if some other company could handle it better. Amazon doesn't seem to crash on Black Friday. So I don't know. It seems like an intractable problem as long as this is the way we're dealing with it. But we don't really know if there's a different way to deal with it. And I think that this is what a lot of the competitors to Ticketmaster would say is, boy, if we only had the chance, we could show that we'll solve this problem. Maybe they could, maybe they can't.
And there are so many layers of problems. There is the actual pricing problem. There's the availability problem. There's the logistics problem. Like, even addressing one of those problems doesn't necessarily solve the entire kind of like workflow issue.
I do think it's worth thinking about the question of, is it a perfect market? Is it a perfect illustration of supply and demand? Because it's often viewed that way. Economists like it for that reason, because they think, oh, look,
I think it's, you know, pure.
It's pure. I don't think it is. I think that there's enough information there that we've seen from like government investigations and reporting. And as you said, there's the whole issue of holdbacks. And what that means is that when an artist puts a show on sale and there's 15,000 seats in the arena, they don't put 15,000 seats on sale. And there might be 1,000 seats that never really go on sale, or that are given out to, you know, in places like New York and LA or maybe Nashville. You know, a large chunk of those might be going to industry people, and there's sponsors, and there's all these other sort of parties that are unknown to the public, and that you are sort of led to think, you know, I'm getting my shot at buying one ticket out of 15,000. It's usually not that case. And the more high profile the show is, the worse that sort of ratio is. And so you get these bigger crushes of thousands and thousands and maybe millions of people trying to get a smaller number of tickets. On the stock market, when there's that imbalance of supply and demand, that pushes the price up. The ticket scalping as it exists now is a very highly sophisticated system in terms of the technology, in terms of even like the financing for how it all works. We can do a whole show on that. I hope sometime we do. But there is the sense of manipulation of supply there. And Live Nation, as well as everybody else in the market, it's not fair to pin this only on them. But, you know, they've been out there in public sort of saying, look, artists are realizing that ticket that they sold for $100 is now selling for $1,000, and they want some of that money. That's money left on the table. It's not fair for that to go into the hands of the scumbag scalpers, right? And so there is that incentive for artists to raise their prices higher and higher. But the question that is never really answered is, how did that $1,000 get there? How was that price set? Was it really set by the dynamics of a perfect trading ecosystem between buyer and seller? Or was it manipulated by some invisible hand that we don't see?
I'm actually glad to hear you say that, because I do think that's sort of a good bow to put on this, because I do think about this a lot, obviously, in terms of some of the other marketplaces that I'm interested in, clothing and sneakers and et cetera. And I do wonder, how did we arrive at $4,000 for the price for this limited sneaker, while this other one that's actually more limited but maybe slightly less coveted is $3,000? Like, these are inventions. These are all this. All of this is an invention at some level. It is not literally all people who wish to buy and all people who wish to sell facing off at the same exact moment and truly testing what a correct price is. They're all, someone is choosing to set that floor or set that ceiling. And I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. So, Ben, see you back here in a year or two or three to have the same conversation, but in connection to a Tokisha concert or something.
I feel like I've had the conversation before and I enjoy it. And sadly, I think it's a perennial. Like, it's going to be needed. It's going to happen again. Perhaps I am cynical about it, but don't expect big changes.
So we'll be back. That is our show. Thank you to Ben. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us podcast@nytimes.com. Buy the t-shirts. I got a bunch of t-shirts left. Not loads, but a few. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Get on the Facebook. Get on the Discord. tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook/podcastdiscord. Subscribe anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We will be back next week. Let's go out with our brothers in arms in Pearl Jam. Let's do that. This is A Lie. Ticketmaster is all around us. It's everywhere. Literally, as we were recording with Ben Cesario, another beloved member of the podcast family was enmeshed in Ticketmaster. I don't want to say drama. Well, maybe it was drama. Karen Gans has arrived to share her live experience of trying to buy Madonna tickets. Karen, you would not let me record you ambiently, field recording style, sitting at your desk trying to purchase Madonna tickets, which I think you've let everybody down by not allowing me to do that. But from what I understand, Joe observed some of your desk situation.
There was some light muttering.
Yeah, some muttering. There were maybe multiple tabs open. Karen, how stressful is it for you as the world's biggest Madonna fan to ensure that you got tickets for all the shows that you wanted to get? How stressful was this experience?
It was stressful. I haven't done it in a while, I have to admit. As a person who writes about pop music, I'm often given press tickets to concerts. But for things like Madonna, you don't risk anything. You just buy them.
You don't risk.
You want them. You need to get them yourself. You need to take care of business. And I pretty much only buy tickets for Madonna at this point. I mean, I help other people buy tickets. But anyway, let's get to the nitty gritty, because I'm actually pretty good at it.
You're an emotional and financial proxy for others in the process.
Yes, I am. I don't want to jinx myself by saying I have the magic touch, but I will say we got what we needed yesterday, and it was stressful. So there were two pre-sales going on. There was like a fan club pre-sale, and believe it or not, I'm not a member of the Madonna fan club. Even though I'm very big.
You invented. I mean, you invented the Madonna fan club.
Some old Madonna fans are going to come and hit me with a club, a physical club.
Literally.
Yes. So you had to be a legacy member of the fan club, i.e. you couldn't have just signed up yesterday and jumped into the pre-sale. They wanted it to be for the real heads, which is fair. I get that.
Yes. You should be grandfathered or grandmothered into that.
Grandladied in.
Yes.
That started at 12. And then at 2, there was a city card pre-sale. Now, I do have a city card, which I use exclusively to buy gasoline for my car, because those cards get hacked a lot from gas stations. Have you ever had that happen to you? The card gets
no.
You've never gotten the old script.
I've never gotten hacked. No.
What
gas stations are you going to?
Gas stations in Brooklyn, John. That's all I'll say.
This is a real personal vibe. We're getting real Ron Lieber territory here.
So I have a credit card I use exclusively for gas, which is my city card, which also offers me opportunities like tickets to Madonna. So I had a bunch of friend groups on different text chains trying to coordinate who had what. The problem was that tickets would pop up and you would click on the little, you know, the little dot on the Ticketmaster map. And then while you were literally saying to somebody, should we pay $6.50? They were gone. But then they would be in that person's basket and they were probably saying to their friend, I don't know about this. And then they would reappear. This happened over the course of an hour. This was an hour long odyssey. I spent an hour buying tickets to Madonna yesterday.
How many tickets in total did you buy?
So here's a funny thing. So I bought four for my core crew that I knew we were going to go together. And then a colleague of ours from the Styles desk, Jacob Bernstein, was
Shout
in touch
Jacob.
With me. Yeah, Jacob. And he had been looking for tickets the whole time as well. However, without a city card. So when the moment of crisis came, Jacob asked if he could use my credit card to buy his tickets. And I said, yes.
Oh my God.
Because this is how collegial I am.
But what would a humble civilian like Jacob, a simple man with no city card, how would Jacob have procured tickets were it not for your city card? Would he have had to stand outside on the corner of the night of the show and beg and plead? Like,
this
what?
Is the pre-sale. Like, it hasn't even gone on sale yet.
But most of the good tickets are probably going to be gone because of the pre-sale.
You know what? I didn't see a ton, because you could see what was available for the fan club too. I didn't see a ton of availability. I think they are saving a lot of them for the regular on sale, perhaps learning a lesson from the Taylor scenario that I'm sure that you and Ben discussed earlier this hour.
But Jacob was not content to wait. He had to have
them. He wanted floor seats and they were right there. And why would he let them go? So Jacob now has all of my information. Jacob, please don't charge anything else.
Please do not. Please do not fuck your child.
There's a low credit limit on that card. And then I still saw some tickets popping up and open and back and up and back and forth near where I bought mine. I bought two more for two other friends of mine. So there is now, Mom, don't listen, $5,000 worth of Madonna tickets on that credit card. LOL.
But, did you find this to be like an intuitive process, or did you find it to be a maddening process?
I mean, I think that the number of people trying to get tickets was a lot lower than for the Taylor tour. Just she was playing stadiums. These are arenas. She's playing a lot more dates. I just think the volume of people was lower. Ticketmaster did not do verified fan for the show, as far as I could tell. But you were in a waiting room, and then it put you in a queue, and it gave you updates about how many people were in front of you. I felt well informed. And then when you got in there, you could sort of, you know, root around again. Things were popping up and back. I did have one snag. When I went to buy the tickets the first time, the charge did not go through because Citi was texting me to make sure that it wasn't a fraudulent $2,500 charge, and I missed the text, so it released the tickets back into the wild, and I gay gasped, and then, but I got them back. It was okay.
Karen.
Yeah.
I'm glad you got your tickets, first of all.
Thank you.
But it does not seem like a particularly soothing experience. My last question is, did you take the day off from work to get tickets?
I did not. I came to the office. I did this from my desk. People were watching me do this. There was an audience.
This is work. Now, to clarify for everybody who's listening, don't do this at work unless you are the pop music editor of the New York Times, in which case it is research.
Yes. I will also say for the hour I spent getting tickets, trust that I did a bonus hour of work at the end of the day, catching up on all my emails. If you didn't get a reply from me yet, don't LOL at that.
One thing we know is Karen loves a bonus hour of work.
I love many bonus hours of work, but the adrenaline of buying tickets is akin to the adrenaline of city biking in New York, or even driving in New York, parking in New York.
So not fun.
it's a burst of energy. It's a little bit of excitement, and you know, knowing that there's going to be a regular on sale, there's a cushion. There's a safety net. If I didn't get tickets yesterday, I would have done the on sale, and if I didn't get it from the on sale, I would have had to look at StubHub, which would be brutal because I'm imagining. So what I ended up paying was all the tickets I bought were $6.50 each. Jacob's came to $500 each. And the ones my friends got for the night before were $500 each. So I'll check in August and let you know how the seats were.
Karen will also be hosting a story sale of all her possessions in order to pay for Madonna tickets this year. So if you're interested in how Karen dresses or any of her furniture, keep an eye on her Instagram. Karen, I will see you at the Madonna show. TBD, maybe, maybe not. We'll see.
Perhaps we go to opening night together.
Sounds like a plan. I'm
in Vancouver in July.
Before we go, this is not for the New York show?
These two were for the New York shows. But that doesn't mean that I'm not interested in attending the tour opener as a news event, or the one in Las Vegas as a gambling event, or the one in Detroit as my friend Ed's birthday event. There was a lot of texts flying yesterday, John.
I do want to say there is no better venue than Popcast to get an unvarnished look into all of our collective mental illness. Thanks, Karen.
It's been my pleasure, John. Thank you.